right, Massachusetts. Okay, so this is Joe Hall. I'm with Carrie Olivia Adams. We're driving to Boston from New York, where we did a couple of readings, and we've just crossed the Massachusetts state line. And I wanted to talk to Carrie about her book, 41 Jane Does, which just came out from Asada Press. And we're doing some readings together, and she's reading from it. And I think it's just a phenomenal book. It's spare, it's haunting. There's a sense of like compression behind the poems that is really rare to find, while still maintaining like kind of an elliptical logic between the lines. So it was a real pleasure to read. And it's one of those kind of books that feels like it's informed by kind of a project, but that project is a little bit below the surface. So I'm wondering if you could just tell us what brought you to 41 Jane Does.
Sure. Thanks, Joe. This is a lot of fun. I definitely always write my books at this point as a project, but I think of them, my first book, Intervening Absence, and this one, I definitely approached already thinking that these poems were going to somehow go together as a whole. And the title poem came about halfway through the project, but it's definitely became the unifying element, and it's named for a drink at one of my favorite bars in Chicago, the Violet Hour. And the Violet Hour, of course, is a line from T.S. Eliot, and many of the drinks share similar sort of poetic names, either are literary allusions of in and of themselves, or just have this sort of quality that I find really evocative. And so I was once drinking this drink, which is with brandy and grandmother's bitters and lots of other delicious wintry things. But I was really entranced by the name and this idea of anonymity that comes through. And there's a lot of different sort of trying on of different female personas that go on in a lot of the poems. And that sort of became the way I didn't realize it until about halfway through that this was becoming a book about different women or different sides of the same woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that comes through. And I think that particularly with the sequence 41 Jane Does, there's a real sense of that anonymity both being like something that's powerful but also renders one vulnerable. And I mean, for you, does that anonymity have something to do, because it's also in like an urban environment, mm-hmm. So to you, is it like a modern, do you think of it as like a modern product? Is it something that is new, or is it always something that, yeah, what's your relationship with that anonymity?
I don't feel like it's specifically a modern product, but my knowledge of it certainly is something that comes from living in a city.
Yeah.
And, I mean, often I get my best sort of notational ideas when I'm riding the bus or the subway and just sort of being surrounded by my immediate community and the sort of my constant curiosity about other people's lives in the role of being a voyeur that the city just kind of naturally allows you to be. And that kind of definitely plays into the anonymity of a lot of these women and certainly sort of the characters that I just passingly imagine within the city. And so for me, I definitely enjoy troubling that line between it being a certain freedom and a certain vulnerability. And that's part of what I love about travel. I love going to places where I'm completely linguistically inept. One of my favorite experiences was being in Sao Paulo, and I don't understand a word of Portuguese, but it's such a global city that everyone would just assume I was Brazilian, so they would come up and talk to me, and I would have to just sort of pantomime my way through life, and I kind of enjoyed that sense of silence that I was able to find in a really, really busy place. And that kind of, to me, is sort of related to the idea of the anonymity that comes through in some of these characters, just kind of being at once very visible and very invisible within a larger urban environment that's going on around you.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, the idea of silence, because when I read the poems, they do seem like poems of traces and gazes and things which are sighted and disappear quickly, but which still leave kind of a mark or a trace. And it makes me think of, you know, Walter Benjamin's idea that the trace first develops in the city, that everybody leaves these clues behind. But maybe the idea of silence is another thing to talk about here. I mean, how does that inform how you write the poems, this interest in silence and how you put them together?
I think it definitely informs my own idea of, I think I'm a fairly spare writer, and I'm always trying to work with that sort of gap that goes between what you articulate and what you kind of leave in the white space. And so that's always been one of the things that I've wanted to play with. But it's strange for me because I actually, all of my poems are written only after I speak them out loud to myself.
Really?
I have to talk to myself the entire time that I'm writing something.
Awesome.
It varies. I mean, I have to do it even in the office when I'm typing the most basic email. It's really, I get strange looks from my coworkers or go by the door. But for me, writing is a very oral process. Like, I have to kind of work out sentences or phrases and hear how they sound before I can actually write them down. And so even if the poems themselves have moments of quiet, they've actually been ones that I've already sort of worked out how you're going to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very much an audio experience to me in both what you hear and what you don't hear.
Yeah. You know, that's fascinating. I really think that is fascinating because I don't know if a lot of people write like that. But when I hear the poems, they do feel like somebody talking, you know? So, like, that spareness doesn't feel like artifice in a way.
Right.
It still feels like somebody completing a thought, but those thoughts may not be connected. Who do you think, we can talk about influence. I know that that's kind of a, you know, fraught even concept, but I mean, where did that come from? Either from experience or reading that movement towards, I think, that the sparseness, which definitely marks this collection.
The question of influence is always one that's it's hard for me to answer because I feel like I get as many of my influences from outside of mm-hmm. poetry and literature than
sure.
I do within. I'm as fascinated by film, of course, as anything else. And that, doesn't that maybe, in some ways, I was, especially because I was making films at the same time as I was working on the poems, I was watching a lot of movies, and I hate to bring up the reference because none of my movies compare, but I was thinking a lot about Malick films, because especially my first film that I made for the book Pandora's Starbox spends a lot of time doing what seems to me like a very Malick-like gesture where it kind of like ponders slow-moving nature and things. You know, it's a cliche in the Malick sort of canon. But Malick is one of those directors who does a lot with silence. I mean, he stretches the limit of the audience to take having the characters not speak at all. And in some ways, I think the poems are reacting to even that kind of play with visuality.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And when people talk about Malick, they often don't like him because of the narration, but the other side of that is a lot of it, you're right, it's not somebody talking.
Right.
There's a lot of just image being allowed to do its work. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, and I mean that opens up this whole other thing, right? Because your book comes with the DVD. And the DVD player on my laptop is broken, so I've only watched one or two of them. But I think was it difficult to make that leap from I'm writing a collection of poems to I'm doing something which is like a multimedia project? Do you consider it like a book of poems plus this extra bonus thing? Or do you think of them as you should really encounter all of these things together?
I think the book can stand alone on its own, but mm-hmm. for me it always was meant to be together, in part just because, well, I knew that the films were always going to be a part of my process of writing those poems. I was never sure whether the films would ever be seen by anybody. When I first started to contemplate the idea, and this was many, many years ago before this was sort of a common thing before Kate Greenstreet's book and all that sort of thing, even though mine is coming out chronologically later. I suffer from this weird thing where I can't really visualize anything in my mind, which seems like a terrible way for a poet to be. So I can't actually hold a picture, and I feel like I don't have any visual imagination whatsoever. And I have to immediately see something to be able to pull out the visual image. And so I started to think about, what if I played with getting a film camera and actually shot things as a way to kind of hold images for myself to help me articulate the visual in a way that I felt I was really struggling with. And so at first I knew I was going to go to Scotland, and I wanted to shoot it just because because I also can't write when I travel. I get kind of immersed in the experience. And so I wanted to save the trip to Scotland somehow so that I could at least have it to refer to. And I was like, well, I'm going to make a poem film, but I don't know if anyone is ever going to see it. It was sort of a strange thing, but I knew that it was going to be a part of my writing process. And in the end, you know, it turned out that I was able to get it placed at a little festival in Chicago, and then I kind of like, well, maybe there's a little market for it, and I started to think about making other poem films. But it was an integral part of the writing process to me. So to some extent, I think you should definitely read the book and watch the films and sort of think about them in consort, but it's not essential. But for me, for the poems that have films, they were sort of happening simultaneously. So the film was in some ways informing what I was writing at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's part of like the pleasure of having these things together, because I've read the book by itself and really enjoyed it. And now, like, I have this other thing to constellate it with, so that the process of reading itself becomes pretty complicated, and I can kind of choose my own way. So I think that's really interesting. So why film instead of just taking like photographs?
Well, that's what I'm going to do now.
Oh, okay. I think,
I've turned away. I'm going super super old school, I think, at this point. I think I did film originally, in part because I like to imagine myself as a film director. Like, it was just a way of thinking for me. I was watching and reading a lot about film, and I had written a sequence in my first book that was called Notes Toward a Short Film. And so that kind of, that general structure was always just kind of fascinating. Mm-hmm. And, so film was just, it was a curiosity, and so I wanted to go after it. But at this point, I have purchased a pinhole camera, and my husband and I have a dark room in our basement, and so I've thought about sort of playing with doing an art book that has images with the pinhole camera, and then maybe done in sort of using older technology where you do sort of more special development, kind of sepia tones or blue tones and things like that.
Right.
I'm turning away from the digital. I realized that I was never going to be the great film director I wanted to be unless I kind of devoted my life to it, and I would rather work on the poems.
Nice.
At this point.
Yeah. Well, if you have a dark room in your basement, it would seem to.
Yeah, you might as well make some
take
photos.
Take advantage of that. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Let's keep talking about film. I mean, are there other directors or other visual artists? Because I know that you have a lot of, you've done writing on visual art. Done writing on film before, right?
Not directly.
Not directly, huh? Or have people in the visual arts written on you? I feel like there's some sort of visual connection here.
I would like
here.
For there to be.
Okay, so.
Not that I know, but maybe you know more than I do. But.
All right. So that was a shitty question, but if you're listening, then
maybe you can be a visual artist who writes about it.
Yeah.
Now the films draw lots of. A little bit of illusions here and there. I was also watching a lot of Bergman films at the time.
Oh,
so
I see that. Yeah.
Through a Glass Darkly kind of pairs with the Winter Came film to some extent. There's the abandoned church that I'm in that film kind of made me feel very much like I was in a Bergman scene. So that was another big influence.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. I mean, I think the spareness of the poems, it seems to reflect those long shots,
yeah.
Right? Long shots that are close in on a character,
Right.
That becomes so long that you lose the thread of, like, the narrative for a second, and you just become engaged in the image as like, a thing in and of itself. Like, it has its thinginess and not, like, its utilization in a plot or narrative or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
where it does both at the same time, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, I really love that effect. I think also just the themes of sometimes of overarching guilt and relationship to whether there's the larger existential questions of identity that Berkman comes through to some extent, especially in that Winter Came poem, was one thing I was playing with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, I think the guilt thing is interesting. And particularly, I was reading the Jane Doe poems at a rest stop, and one of the interesting things about those poems was you have a sense of anonymity on one hand of the person in the public space, and it seems like on another hand there is a knowledge, a self-knowledge of the characters of, I guess, of shame or guilt or something like that. And it seems to play really interestingly together. Are there other things in which, like, are there other impulses for that sort of, like, internal processing of stuff in the poems? Because a lot of poems, I think, that aren't lyric narrative poems, right, seem to be totally directed outward. Like, they come like, a floating eyeball who kind of knows everything magically and puts together its kind of thesis on the world outside. But there is a sense of a person working through things that are troubling them. Why is that important to you, I guess?
Yeah. But I think that's the only real reason I write, I guess, is out of this great sense of empathy. And I'm very interested in those sort of, the kind of questions that connect us to each other, the kinds of things I think we're all struggling with. And I feel like I've always wanted my poems to be kind of these little messages to strangers in the dark out there. Like, for a long time, you know, I'm an only child, and I had this, perhaps as a result of that, or who knows what, sort of just ingrained sense of loneliness. And literature was always sort of my connection to the rest of the world, and that sense of, like, whatever I was feeling wasn't that strange. And I've kind of always wanted my poems to kind of provide that sense of, not necessarily comfort, because I don't think my poems are incredibly comforting, but just that sense of sympathy or empathy, or that there's at least a fellow traveler with you through all of this. And I just, it's hard for me to just be an observer. I kind of, what interests me is always how people can turn external things back inside themselves. And it's just sort of, I'm kind of a quiet stare out the window kind of person, and that just kind of, I think, comes through in the writing process itself.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, it's not about, like, comfort, but there's recognition in the poems,
right?
Like, I do get the sense that these are coming from a human, right? And whether or not that person's in a comfortable place,
right,
is a different question. All right, let's do some greatest hits for questions, and some of these are going to be stolen from other people.
All right.
But really quickly, what are some of your favorite poets? I know that these are, like, childish questions, yeah, but I feel like there's an impulse to be smart, and I myself am always trying to make really complicated questions. So,
well, Joe Hall is one of my favorite poets.
Yeah.
To have found you in the slush pile of of submissions in our first open reading was an incredible experience. But I always feel terrible answering this question, because I feel like my answers are so cliche and old-fashioned. Like, I still read a lot of Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not ashamed of that. And I, my first book spent a lot of time thinking about Susan Howe, and I think that there's a little bit of that in this second book as far as what I was reading at the time. I was actually reading a lot of Simone Weil, so there was as much philosophy going on as there was poetry in some ways. I love Anne Carson for the different sort of formal projects she takes on and that sense of experimentation.
Sorry. Sorry, my alarm just went off. Sorry. Interview. Okay.
And I coughed on the alarm.
Okay, so those are the...
Yeah, those are sort of my
totally
top three at
that.
This point.
Yeah. What about... All right, so here's another golden oldie question. What is your first memory of writing?
I remember writing this poem about this kind of daffodil in my mother's garden that was called a tete-a-tete daffodil. And I was maybe four. I had a little book that my mom gave me so I could write down poems in when I was around four or five. And I must have been a little bit older enough that I could actually write the letters out. But I remember kind of like writing down the name from the little slip that was in the gardening case, and it just being really interested in the sounds. I was kind of obsessed with foreign words when I was a little kid. My first pet was a black and white rabbit my parents gave me when I was five, and I was living in New York, and there was some commercial that came on television where the like grandmotherly lady said, you know, this sauce has chutzpah, and I was like, chutzpah, that is a fantastic word. I had no idea what it meant.
Right.
So I named my pet chutzpah. And it's the same sort of thing. I think my first poem comes out of this, like, oh, there's this French term, tete-a-tete. And I'm like, that's cool. I don't even...
Right.
I have no idea what I'm writing about other than, like, I like how this word sounds.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. Yeah, that you do sound all the poems out at once. It's definitely a Dickinson connection there if you're writing poems about
that.
That's
right.
Poems. Yeah, yeah. Does you're learning Japanese right now. Does that have something to do with it? With enjoying the foreignness of something that is unrecognizable and encountering it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I mean, Japanese, I'm now going to have to be doing for the rest of my life to ever really learn it the way I want to. But the way it rewires my thinking about sentences and language and sound in general has been really informative. And I would like to play with it in my poems. I have not really incorporated yet my thinking about Japanese into my thinking about poem structure, but I'm thinking that might be a part of whatever project I pursue next, just kind of working with a new form of syntax, kind of troubling syntax in a way that Japanese has kind of taught me to think about.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I think that can be really sort of a flash of something unexpected in a poem. That can unsettle the terrain a little bit. I really enjoy Young Mi Kim's poems for that, and my friend J. Michael Martinez, when just a different language emerges as a thread in the poem to remind you that English is of itself, like, it's an artificial construct. It's one way of doing things. Yeah. All right. Let me ask you one last question. Are you ready for this? We're going to do a reading tonight in Boston. Are you ready to do your third reading in 3 days?
I am totally ready. Yeah. I haven't actually picked out what I'm going to read.
Okay.
But other than that, I'm ready.
You're ready.
Seven readers in 70 minutes.
Okay.
You're going to have to be ready.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I need to get ready too. All right. Well, I totally think, listening audience, that you should read Carrie's book in conclusion. And
thanks for joining us on this road trip.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on this road trip. We paid a toll while driving. Yeah, all right.
Awesome.
That's all. Yeah, probably edit out the last 2 minutes of this.